my mouth.
Still dazed, I tried another desperate tack.
I'll tell Mefrou,
I shouted, trying to sound threatening.
Mefrou kan gaan kak.
Mefrou can go to shit. The judge spat on the ground, this time with a proper, not a chicken shit spit. He turned to the stormtroopers.
Prisoner of war, Kaffir Chicken Rennick will be executed. 2 shots each.
He moved to take his place in the shooting line, as the rest of the stormtroopers loaded up their catapults. I sloughed off the last of my camouflage.
I'll tell Mr. Stoffel about how I did your arithmetic for you,
I screamed at the judge. I heard the soft pfft of his catapult at the same time as I felt the stone slam into my stomach. The pain was terrible. It seemed to be happening in slow motion, as though the stone had a life of its own, gnawing at my gut, burning and squirming through my intestines and into my back. A vicious, determined, alive, eyeless thing. The shock to my system was enormous. My eyes bugged out of my head, and my tongue poked out in involuntary surprise.
Fire!
A series of dull plops tore into the fragile bones of Grandpa Chook's breast. The first stones had set the ropes swinging, but the stormtroopers were expert shots, and their second shots also tore into the funny old body of that upside-down chicken. Spots of blood dropped into the dry dust, and among the fallen jacaranda blossoms, the ropes swinging so that no 2 drops landed in the same place. Grandpa Chook, the toughest damn chicken in the whole world, was dead. A tiny feather drifted towards me. It was one of the soft downy ones which grew at the very top of Grandpa Chook's scrawny legs. It stuck to a piece of shit in my face. The judge walked over and untied the rope from around my waist, and I dropped to my haunches at his feet. He placed his bare foot on my shoulder.
What are you, Englishman?
Dog shit, sir.
Look at me when you say it,
he barked. Slowly I looked up at the giant with his foot resting on my shoulder. High above him I could see a milky moon hanging in the afternoon sky. We had got so close. Grandpa Chook and I had got so close to making it through to the end. Just a few more hours. I spat at him.
You're dog shit! Your ma is a whore!
He pushed violently downwards with his foot, sending me sprawling. Then he let out a howl, a mixture of anger and anguish.
Why don't you cry, you fucking bastard?
He sobbed, and started to kick blindly at me. The stormtroopers rushed to restrain him, pulling him from me. The judge allowed himself to be led away, and we were left alone behind the shithouses under a white moon, set in a flawless blue sky. I untied the broken body of Grandpa Chook, and we sat under the jacaranda tree, and I stroked his bloody feathers. No more gentle African dawn folding back the night. No more early cock-a-doodle-doo to tell me you are there, my loved and faithful chicken friend. Who will peck my ear? Who will be my friend? I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. The great drought was over. The inside man was out. The rains had come to Zululand. After a long, long while, when the crying was all out of me, and the loneliness bird had entered to build a nest of stones in the hollow place inside of me, I carried Grandpa Chook to the orchard and laid him in the place I had made for him to keep him from the rain. Then I climbed through the window into the dormitory to fetch my new red jumper, the one my mother had knitted in the concentration camp and Nanny had fixed. I gathered as many rocks as I could find, and then I pulled my red jumper over Grandpa Chook's body. His wings poked out of the armholes, and his long neck stuck out of the head part, and his feet poked out of the bottom. He looked the best I'd ever seen him. I took the jam tin I had used for his water, and in about 5 minutes I'd collected 20 little green grasshoppers, which are the very best chicken scoff there is. I placed the tin beside his body so that he'd have a special treat on the way to heaven. Finally, I covered his body with the stones. South Africa's first victim in the war against Adolf Hitler was safe at last. I sat there on my haunches beside the pile of stones as the afternoon sun began to set. Now the sun was passing beyond Zululand, even past the land of the Swazi, and now it leaves the Shangaan and the royal kraal of Mojaji, the Rain Queen, to be cooled in the great dark water beyond. The first bell for supper rang, and I moved to the tap and began to wash the blood and shit from my hands and face and hair. Deep inside me, the loneliness bird sat on its crude stone nest and laid a large and very heavy stone egg. The bell for supper sounded. The last supper. Everything comes to an end. Tomorrow I'd be going home for Christmas, and Nanny, wonderful, soft, warm Nanny. But life doesn't work that way. I, most of all, should have known this. At supper, Boetie van der Merwe told me Mevrouw wanted to see me in the dispensary.
"If you tell about this afternoon, we'll kill you," he hissed.
I wasn't frightened. I knew a proper ending when I saw one. Only hours remained before my liberation. Nothing the judge, Mevrouw, and for the moment anyway, Adolf Hitler could do would alter that. Soon I would be returning to my quiet backwater. I didn't know then that what seemed like the end was only the beginning. All children are flotsam, driven by the ebb and flow of adult lives. Unbeknownst to me, the tide had turned, and I was being swept out to sea. 4. At the end of supper, after Mr. Stoffel had read the Bible lesson and concluded evening prayers, I waited for Mevrouw outside the dispensary. She arrived a short time later.
"Come,"
Mevrouw said as she brushed past me. I entered and waited with my hands behind my back, my head bowed in the customary manner.
"Why is there blood on your shirt, Biscop?"
I looked down at my shirt, which was stained with Grandpa Chuck's blood, and a biggish spot where the stone had torn into me. Mevrouw sighed and sat down heavily on a bent wood chair, painted the same light green as the dispensary walls.
"Take off your shirt," she commanded.
I hurriedly removed my shirt, and Mevrouw made a cursory examination of my stomach.
"Ach, is that all?"
She prodded at the wound the stone had made, and I flinched involuntarily.
"Please, Mevrouw, I fell on a rock."
Mevrouw removed the cork from a large bottle of iodine and upended it onto a wad of cotton wool.
"Yes, I can see that."
She dabbed at my wound, and the iodine stung like bilio, and I winced and hopped up and down in dismay, wringing my hands to stop the burning pain.
"Come, that's not enough."
She upended the bottle once again and dabbed hard at my tummy. This time I knew what to expect, and gritting my teeth and closing my eyes tightly, I managed to hold back most of the pain.
"You can't go getting blood poisoning on the train," she said, tossing the wad on the table.
She retrieved the cork and pushed it back into the bottle.
"What train, Mevrouw?"
I asked, confused.
"Your opa called long distance on the telephone from a dorp in the eastern Transvaal called Barberton. You are not going back to the farm. He says Newcastle's disease has made him kill all his chickens, and he has sold the farm to a Mevrouw Forster."
"What's my grandpa doing in this town called Barberton, Mevrouw?" My head was swimming. My whole world was coming apart at the seams. If Grandpa had sold the farm to fat Mrs. Forster, and was making telephone calls from some strange town in the eastern Transvaal, where was Nanny? Without Grandpa Chuck and Nanny, life was not possible.
"I'm not a mind reader. Maybe he got work in this place."
She reached into her bag and held up an envelope. "In here is the ticket. Tomorrow night you will catch the train to Barberton. 2 days and two nights. I will take you to the train." She dismissed me with a wave of the envelope. I turned to go, and as I reached the door, Mevrouw called me back.
"You can't take the chicken, you hear?"
She looked at me smugly.
"South African railways won't let you take a Kaffir chicken, not even in the goods van."
She seemed pleased with this thought.
"I will take the chicken. He will earn his keep even if he is only a Kaffir chicken."
"He's dead, Mevrouw. A dog ate him today."
I managed somehow to keep the tears out of my voice.
"That is a shame. He was good in the kitchen."
She rose from her chair with a sigh, fanning herself with the letter.
I'm telling you, man, a Kaffir chicken is no different from a Kaffir. Just when you think you can trust them, they go and let you down.
I had never owned a pair of shoes. At that time in the northern Transvaal, a farm kid only got boots if he had rich parents or if he had turned 13. That's when the Old Testament says a boy becomes a man. A pair of khaki shorts, a shirt and a jumper when it was cold was all you got. Underpants hadn't been invented. Even if they had been, Boer kids wouldn't have worn them. More expense for what? The day after Grandpa Chook's funeral was the last day of term. Everyone was up and packed long before breakfast. After breakfast, Mefro summoned me to the dispensary to tell me that after lunch we would be going into town to buy a pair of tackies for me at Harry Crown's shop.
What are tackies, Mefro?
Domkop. Tackies are shoes only made of canvas with rubber bottoms. Don't you know anything? Make sure you have clean feet, or we'll be shamed in front of the Jew.
From my secret mango tree, I watched the kids leave the hostel. Parents arrived in old pickup trucks and mule carts. Some kids left on donkeys brought to the school by a farm servant. I watched as the judge left in a mule cart. He made the black servant sit on the tailboard, then he jumped up into the driver's seat, took up the reins and the whip, and set off at a furious pace, whipping at the mules and making the whip crack like a rifle shot. I breathed a huge sigh of relief. As my mother used to say, good riddance of bad rubbish. Finally everyone had gone, and I climbed down from the mango tree and crossed the school playground. It wasn't the same without Grandpa Chook. The sun felt the same. The little green grasshoppers still couldn't make it across the playground in one hit. The day moon, made of skimmed milk, still hung in the cloudless morning sky. But it wasn't ever going to be the same again. I saved the need to grieve for a later time. I had enough on my mind with the prospect of going to town to buy a pair of shoes and catching the train. I'd never owned a pair of shoes, and I'd never been on a train, never even seen a real train. Two nevers in one day is enough to fill anyone's mind. After lunch of bread and jam with a mug of sweet tea, I hurried to meet Mefro in the dispensary, stopping only long enough to give my feet and legs a good scrub, like Mefro said. The same shower which had been dripping that first night when I thought I was in a slaughterhouse was still sounding drip, drip, drip like a metronome. Funny how little kids can get things mixed up like that. It all seemed such a long time ago. I sure had been a baby then. I'd been waiting at the dispensary a few minutes when Mefro arrived. She was wearing a shapeless floral cotton dress and a funny old black straw hat with two cherries on it. A third wire stem stuck up where a cherry had once been. In her town clothes, she looked not unlike fat old Mrs. Forster, except younger and with a moustache. The town I knew to be about 2 miles from the school.
"Maybe we could visit the railway station as well as Harry Crown's shop," I suggested tentatively.
"It is enough that I do this for you, Piscop. What do you want, blood from a stone? Tonight I must do it all over again for you. There is nothing at the station to see, only sleeping Kaffirs waiting for the train."
For the remainder of the journey we said nothing. Mefro walked 3 paces ahead of me all the way to town. Her huge shape sort of rocked along, stopping every once in a while to catch her breath. The early afternoon sun beat down on us. By the time we arrived, Mefro was very hot and bothered, and her special smell was worse than ever. Harry Crown's shop was closed, and nothing much seemed to be happening in the main street. Mefro took a large red duck from her basket and proceeded to wipe her face.
"Everyone is still having their lunch. We must wait," she explained.
With great effort, she climbed the 5 steps up to the stoop of the shop and sat down on a bench beside the padlocked door.
"Go and find a tap and wash your feet," she panted.
I crossed the street to the garage, which had a sign which read Atlantic Service Station. It had 2 pumps outside a small office and workshop bay. Just inside the bay was a tap. The whole place smelt of oil and grease. I washed my feet and walked back across the road on my heels, so as not to dirty my feet. 6 Africans were asleep at the far end of the veranda, where there was a second entrance to the shop. Above this entrance was written, "Blacks Only." I wondered briefly why whites were not allowed to enter. Flies, flying heavy in the heat, settled on sleeping eyes, and every now and then a desultory black hand would come up and brush at them, its owner seemingly still asleep. One black man with his left eye missing remained awake and sat with his back against the shop wall. His cupped hands and mouth concealed a Jew's harp, which twanged in urgent rhythm.
"The Jew is late. Who does he think he is?"
Mufro said impatiently. She half-turned and addressed the African playing the Jew's harp.
"Hey, Kaffer! Where is the bus?"
The black man jumped to his feet, removing the tiny harp and placing it in the pocket of his ragged pants. He said nothing, not understanding Afrikaans.
"Do you work here?" I asked him in Shangaan.
"No, small boss. I am waiting. The big boss for the shop will be here soon, I think. When the hutter goes for the sawmill, he will surely come. He doesn't work for Mr. Crown, mevrouw."
Just then a hutter sounded. We were familiar with the sawmill hutter, which blew at 1 o'clock and again at 2. Almost on the dot, a big black Chevrolet drove up and parked outside the shop. It was the most beautiful car I'd ever seen. I'd never imagined a motor car could be as shiny and powerful. The man inside it revved the engine before he cut the ignition, and it roared as though alive. Obviously, being a Jew was a very profitable business. Maybe I could be one when I grew up. Harry Crown was a fat man in his late 50s. He wore his trousers high so that his entire tummy and most of his chest were covered with trouser top, held up by a pair of bright red braces. His white open-neck cotton shirt seemed to extend no more than 8 inches from his collar before it was swallowed by his trousers. He was almost completely bald, and when he smiled he showed 2 gold front teeth.
"A 1,000 apologies, mevrouw. Have you been waiting long?"
he said, making a fuss of unlocking the padlocked doors to the shop.
"Ach, it was nothing, not even a few minutes,"
mevrouw said, all smiles for the fat, bald man. In the part boarded off for white customers, 2 large ceiling fans whirred softly overhead, and the shop was dark and cool. Mevrouw heaved herself gratefully onto a chair beside the counter, and Harry Crown poured her a cup of coffee from a pot he removed from a small hot plate on a shelf behind the counter.
"What can I do for you, mevrouw?" he asked.
Then turning to me, he bowed slightly.
"And for you, mister," he said solemnly.
I was not used to jocularity, so not knowing what to do, I dropped my eyes to avoid his gaze. Observing my shyness, he turned from me to a large glass jar on the counter, and from it produced a raspberry sucker, its ruby head wrapped in cellophane. He held the sucker out for me to take. I looked at mevrouw, who took a polite sip from her coffee cup and then nodded. I took the delicious prize and put it into my shirt pocket.
"Thank you, meneer," I said softly.
"Ach, eat it now, boy. When we have finished business, you can have another one."
He paused.
"A green one, maybe, eh?"
He turned to mevrouw.
"I have had this shop for 30 years, and I can tell you with God's certainty that children like raspberry first and green second. If I know nothing for certain in this life, of this one thing I am sure."
He snapped his braces with his thumbs and gave a loud, happy snort. I had never met a man who laughed and carried on like this, and I felt intimidated. So I left the raspberry sucker in my pocket where I hoped it was safe.
"What is your name, boy?" Harry Crown asked.
"Perskop, sir," I replied.
Harry Crown's shiny, bald head jerked back, and he looked down at me in consternation.
"Perskop? Perskop? This is a name for a nice boy?"
he asked in alarm.
"Who calls you this name?"
Mevrouw interrupted sharply.
"Never mind his name. What have you got in techies? The boy must have some techies. He's going on the train alone tonight to his opa in Barberton."
Turning momentarily to acknowledge he had heard her, Harry Crown turned back to me and gave a low whistle.
"Barberton, eh? That is in the Lowveld in the Eastern Transvaal. Easy 2 days away in the train, a long journey alone for a small boy."
He had moved around from behind the counter and was looking at my feet.
"We have nothing so small, mevrouw. I don't have much call for techies. The boer around here don't play much tennis."
He chortled loudly at his own joke, which was completely lost on mevrouw and me.
"Show me what you got, Mr. Crown. His opa did not send enough money for boots, only techies." "It makes no difference, boots, smoots, techies, schmeckies, the boy's foot's too small."
He moved back behind the counter, where he pulled a battered cardboard box from the shelf. From it he withdrew a pair of dark brown canvas shoes.
Let the boy try them, Mevrouw said.
It is useless, Mevrouw. These tackies are 4 sizes too big for him. It is a miracle I have these, but they're too big already.
The boy will grow, Mevrouw said a trifle impatiently.
Yes, certainly, Mevrouw. Maybe in 5 or 6 years they will fit him like a glove. In the meantime, they will fit him like the clown in the circus.
He slapped his stomach.
Very amusing, he said to himself in English.
We will try them on. With newspaper we can fix them.
Mevrouw, with the holes uit pants per gazette, we couldn't stuff these tackies to fit. He has very small feet for a boer child.
He's not a boer child. He's a Roenick, Mevrouw said, suddenly angry. She put the cup of coffee down on the counter and, leaning over, grabbed the tackies and turned to me.
Put your foot up here on my lap, child,
she ordered. The first tacky slipped around my foot without touching the sides. With my heel on Mevrouw's lap, the canvas shoes seemed to reach almost up to my chin. Mevrouw pulled the laces tightly until the eyelets overlapped.
Now the other one, she said.
I stood there, rooted to the floor, not daring to move and not knowing what to do next. The tackies seemed to extend twice the distance of my feet.
Walk, child, Mevrouw commanded.
I took a tentative step forward, and the left tacky stayed behind on the floor, though I managed to drag the right one forward by not lifting my foot.
Bring some paper.
Mevrouw cunningly fashioned 2 little boats from strips of newspaper. She then put the paper boats in the tackies and instructed me to insert my feet into them and tie the laces. This time they fitted snug as a bug in a rug, though I must say they felt very strained, and when I walked, they made a flift-floft sound where the tackies bent at the end of my toes. I had never felt as grand in all my life.
We will take them, Mevrouw announced triumphantly.
She reached into her handbag for her purse. Harry Crown sighed.
Those tackies are no good, Mevrouw.
If Mevrouw had had her shambok, she would have made fat old Harry Crown bend over the counter, and she would have given him 6 of the best.
How much? She said curtly, her lips pursed. 1/2 crown for you, only 2 shillings.
Harry Crown said, adjusting the price automatically, his heart obviously not in the sale. I tugged at the end of a lace, and to my relief the bow collapsed. I did the same for the second tacky, then slipped ever so carefully out of the newspaper boats and handed the tackies to Harry Crown.
You poor little bugger, he said in English.
He slipped the tackies back into the soft brown cardboard box, and when he saw Mevrouw wasn't looking, quickly put 2 green and 2 red suckers into the box and handed it to me.
I wish you health to wear them,
Harry Crown said in English. Speaking out of the corner of his mouth, he added,
Can she understand English?
Not daring to reply, I shook my head almost imperceptibly, indicating no.
Inside is for the journey. Red and green, the best. Believe me, I know. So long, P.K.
He patted me on the shoulder. His eyes widened, and drawing up to his full height, his hands clasped over his belly, gold teeth flashing, he grinned.
Maybe the tackies don't fit, but I think your new name fits perfectly. P.K. Yeah, that is a nice name for a brave person who is travelling by himself to the Lowveld to meet his grandpa.
Mevrouw, who was practically snorting with rage, threw 2 shillings on the counter and marched out of the shop. I followed along with the precious box of loot under my arm. At the door, I turned to say goodbye to Harry Crown.
Goodbye, sir,
I said in English. The 2 English words sounded strangely out of place, like a language newly learned. Mevrouw turned furiously. Grabbing me by the ear, she hissed,
Do not talk to that dirty Jew in the accursed language. You will hear from my shambok when we get home.
Ouch! You hurt my sore ear, Mevrouw.
I knew immediately she'd feel guilty grabbing me by my recently damaged ear, even though it was completely healed. Mevrouw let go of my ear as though it were a red-hot poker. You've got to be quick on your feet in this world if you want to survive. Though once you know the rules, it is not too hard to play the game. Mevrouw stormed ahead, and I fell some 5 paces behind her. After I'd given her what I hoped was enough guilt for her to withdraw the promised thrashing, I dropped back another 15 paces, and took the raspberry sucker out of my pocket. Taking off the cellophane wrapper, I licked the tiny bits of crimson sugar crystal which had stuck to it before throwing it away. I then settled down to suck my way back to the hostel. I was right about the shambok, which was not mentioned on our return. I spent the remainder of the afternoon putting more stones on Grandpa Chook's grave, and making a border around the pile of rocks with white pebbles, which took ages to collect from all around the place. I must say the toughest damn chicken in the whole world had a very impressive grave, a stone cairn which would probably last forever, hidden by successive generations of khaki weed and blackjack. The cook boy had packed me a big brown paper bag of sandwiches for the train journey. We left the hostel about 5 o'clock to catch the 7 o'clock train. My suitcase, though large, contained very few things. 2 shirts, 2 pairs of khaki shorts, my pajamas, the 4 suckers which I'd hidden in a pair of shorts, and my new tackies with the paper boats in them. There was plenty of room for the sandwiches. While the suitcase banged against my knees, it wasn't really heavy, and besides, with all the iron bar torture sessions, my muscles were pretty big. Mefro was completely puffed out from making 2 trips into town in 1 day, and with the suitcase banging against my knees, it took us almost an hour to get to the station. The station turned out to be a raised platform about 30 yards long, upon which sat a building with 2 doors facing the railway line. On 1 door, Station Master was written, and to the right of this door was a window. Above the window it read, Tickets. On the remaining door it said, Waiting Room. Outside the Station Master's office there were 3 truck tires painted white, and in the middle of these grew red cannas, their long flat leaves dusty and shredded with the blooms equally torn and bedraggled-looking. Mefro seemed to know the Station Master. He opened the locked waiting room for us and brought her a cup of coffee in a big white cup with S.A.R. monogrammed on it.
Don't worry, Hoppy Grunewald is the guard on this train. He will take good care of the boy.
He turned to acknowledge me for the first time.
This champion of the railways, you know that, Hoppy?
The station master grinned at the thought.
He laughs all the time, but if you get into a fight, I'm telling you, man, you better pray he's on your side.
I wondered what a champion of the railways was. But I clearly understood and greatly liked the idea of having someone on my side who was good in a fight. My life seemed to have been made for trouble, and it would make a nice change to have a champion of the railways beside me when the next lot hit, as was bound to happen. Sometimes the slightest things change the directions of our lives. The merest breath of a circumstance. A random moment that connects like a meteorite striking the earth. Lives have swiveled and changed direction on the strength of a chance remark. Hoppy Grunewald was to prove to be a passing mentor who would set the next 17 years of my life on an irrevocable course. He would do so in little more than a day and a night.
The boys are Reynek and also too small to fight yet,
Mefro said, as though it were only a matter of time before my bad English blood would turn nasty. She produced a ticket from an envelope and inserted a large safety pin into the hole at one end.
Come here, child.
She pinned the ticket to my shirt pocket.
Listen carefully to me now, man. This ticket will take you to Barberton, but your oppa only sent enough money for 1 breakfast and 1 lunch and 1 supper on the train. Tonight you eat only 1 sandwich, you hear?
I nodded.
Tomorrow for breakfast, another one, and for lunch, the last one. Then you can eat on the train. Do you understand now?
Yeah, Mefer. For the next 3 meals, I eat the sandwiches.
No, man, that's not what I said. For tonight and for breakfast tomorrow and lunch tomorrow. And also eat the meat first, because the jam will keep the bread soft for tomorrow. Do you hear?
Ja, mevrouw.
She took out a small square of white cloth about the size of a lady's hanky and placed it on her lap. In the center she placed a shilling.
Watch carefully now, Puskop. I'm putting this shilling in here and tying it so.
She brought the 2 opposite corners together and tied them over the shilling, and then did the same with the remaining 2. She took a 2nd large safety pin from her handbag, then, pushing the duck with the shilling into the pocket of my khaki shorts, she pinned it to the lining.
Now listen good. It is for an emergency. Only if you have to can you use some of it. But you must tie up the change, like I just showed you, and put it back in your pocket with the safety pin. If you don't need it, you must give it to your opa. It is his change.
The station master entered and told us that the train was on time and we had 5 minutes.
Quick, man, get your techies,
Mefro said, giving me a push towards the suitcase. I was seized by a sudden panic. What if I opened my suitcase and she saw my suckers? I placed the case flat on the floor and opened it so the lid was between Mefro and me, preventing her from seeing inside.
just as well. A green sucker had worked out of its hiding place in my shorts, and my heart went thump. Phew. I removed the tackies and quickly snapped the case shut. I slipped each foot carefully into a paper boat and my throat tied the laces. I tried desperately to memorize how she did this, but wasn't sure I had the idea.
"Please, Mefro, will you teach me how to tie the laces so I can take my tackies off in the train?"
Mefro looked up, alarmed.
"You must not take your tackies off until you get to Barberton. If you lose them, your opa will think I stole the money," he said. "You keep them on, do you hear me now?"
The train could be heard a long way off, and we left the waiting room to watch it coming in. Real walking in my tackies was difficult and very different from the 3 or 4 tentative steps I had taken in Harry Crown's shop. I stumbled several times as I went flift-fluffed, flift-fluffed from the waiting room to the edge of the platform. Bits of newspaper crept up past my ankles, and I had to stop and press them back in. With a deafening chuff of steam, immediately followed by 2 short, sharp hisses and a screeching sound of metal rubbing on metal, the huge train pulled into the station, and carriage after carriage of black people went by. They were laughing and sticking their heads out of the windows and having themselves a proper good time. Finally, the last 2 carriages and the goods van came to a halt, neatly lined up with the platform. The 2 end carriages read South African Railways First Class and Second Class, respectively. I had seen pictures of trains, of course, and sometimes at night, as I lay in the small kid's dormitory, I had heard a train whistle carried in the wind. The beautiful sound of going to faraway places, away from the hostel, the throw, the judge and his Nazi stormtroopers. But I must say I wasn't prepared for anything quite as big and black and blustering with steam, smoke, fire, brass pipes and hissing pistons. Africans appeared as if from nowhere. They carried bundles on their heads, which they handed up through the third-class carriage windows to the passengers inside, and then climbed aboard, laughing with the excitement of it all. From inside the carriages came song and more laughter, and a great deal of shouting and good-natured banter. I knew at once that I would like trains. The guard leapt down onto the platform, carrying a canvas bag with mail stamped on the outside. He handed it to the station master, who gave him an identical bag in return. The station master introduced the guard to Mefro.
"This is Hoppy Groenewald. He is guard and conductor until you get to Gavelot. He will look after the boy."
Hoppy Groenewald grinned down at me and tipped his navy blue guard's cap to Mefro.
"No worries, Mefro. I will look after him until Gavelot. Then I will hand him over to Pik Porter, who will take him through to Kapmaiden."
He opened the door of the second-class carriage and put my suitcase into the train and indicated that I should enter. The 3 steps up into the carriage were fairly high, and I put my tackied foot on the bottom step. As I put my weight on the step, the toe of the tacky buckled, and I fell on my bum on the platform. Wearing shoes was a much trickier business than I had first supposed. A bit distressed, I wondered how adults seemed to manage so easily. I tried to get up, but the tackies were too big, and I couldn't get a proper grip on the loose gravel which covered the platform.
"Get up, man,"
Mefro said, visibly annoyed. She shook her head.
"For God's sake, even now you make trouble for me."
Hoppy Groenewald put the canvas mailbag on the platform, and bending down he grabbed me under the armpits and hoisted me high into the air and through the door to land inside the carriage.
"No worries, little brother. I too have fallen up those verdomde steps many a time. I, who am a guard and soon to be a conductor and who should know better."
He retrieved the mail bag and put it next to my suitcase. Then he hopped up the steps without even looking and unhooked a neatly rolled green flag from above the door of the carriage. He unfurled the flag and absently pulled at a chain attached to a button on his navy serge waistcoat and withdrew a large silver whistle from his fob pocket.
"Watch the Kaffirs get a fright," he said with a grin.
He showed me how to hold onto the handrail inside the door and lean out of the carriage so I could see down the full length of the train to the third-class carriages. He then jumped back onto the platform and began to wave the flag, giving a long blast on his whistle. You should have seen the kerfuffle. Africans who had left the train to stretch their legs or have a pee scrambled frantically to get through the doors of the carriages as the train began slowly to move, laughing and yelling and climbing on top of each other. Hoppy Groenewald gave 2 more short blasts on his whistle and hopped aboard the train.
"Goodbye, Mefro. Thank you,"
I shouted, waving at her.
"Keep your tackies on, you hear?"
Mefro shouted back.
It was a dry-eyed farewell on both sides. I ardently hoped the Roenick and Mefreux would never have to see each other again. Hoppy Grunewald closed the carriage door as the train began to gather momentum. He quickly refurled the flag and clicked it back into its holder next to a red one above the door. Then he picked up my suitcase and opened the door to the nearest compartment. The train was moving along smoothly now, and I enjoyed the comforting, predictable clackety-clack, clackety-clack of the carriage wheels. The empty compartment had two bright green leather seats facing each other, each seat big enough for three adults. A small table, which I was later to discover turned into a wash basin, was positioned between the two windows. The rest of the compartment seemed to be panelled in highly varnished wood, and immediately above each green leather seat was a glass frame about 10 inches high running the length of the seats. Inside the frames were lots of photographs. It was all very posh. Before it got completely dark, Hoppy Grunewald turned on the compartment lights, and all seemed very cozy. Just like the beginning of a proper adventure.
It's all yours until we get to Zinin. After that, who knows? No worries, Hoppy will take good care of you.
He looked down at my tackies. Bits of newspaper were sticking out of the sides and up past my ankles.
The old cow can't get you now. Take them off, the guard said.
I tugged the canvas shoes off. My feet were hot and uncomfortable, and had turned black from the newsprint rubbing off on them. It felt delicious to squiggle my toes again. Hoppy Grunewald stuck his hand out.
Shakerpoor, you know my name, but I haven't had the pleasure.
I'd already thought about what Harry Crown had said, and had decided to take his advice and call myself P.K.
P.K.,
I said tentatively. I pronounced it in English, the way Harry Crown had, so it sounded like a proper name. I suddenly felt new and clean. Nobody ever again would know that I had been called Piscop. Grandpa Chook was dead, and so was Piscop, the first two South African casualties in the Second World War.
All the best, PK. We will be pals.
He took his cap off and put it on my head. I wondered if he was a Nazi. He didn't seem to know I was English, so why tempt fate?
Thank you for taking care of me, Mr. Grunewald, I said politely, and handed him back his cap.
Ach, man, just call me Hoppy.
He grinned as he replaced his cap. Hoppy left to check the tickets in the African carriages, but promised he would return soon. It was almost totally dark outside, as I sat alone in a lighted room, flying through the African night, lickety-clack, lickety-clack. I had defeated the judge and his Nazi stormtroopers, survived Mefreux, and I had grown up and changed my name, lickety-clack, lickety-clack. Opening my suitcase, I took out one of Harry Crown's green suckers. Carefully removing the cellophane wrapper, I licked the bits of green sugar that had stuck to it. The faint taste of lime transferred to my tongue, sweet promise of the main event when I began on the sucker itself. Harry Crown was right. Of course, the green ones were very close second to the raspberry. I examined the photographs above the seats, sepia-toned pictures of a flat mountain with a streak of white cloud resting just above it. The caption underneath read, "World-famous Table Mountain wearing its renowned tablecloth." All there was a big white cloud above it, but I couldn't see a renowned tablecloth. Another showed a big city seen from the air with the caption, "Cape Town, home of the famous Cape Doctor." I wondered what the doctor had done to be famous and rich enough to own a big town for his home. He must have been richer even than Harry Crown. Years later, I discovered that the Cape Doctor was a wind which blew in early spring to clean out the flu germs and general accumulated nasties that had gathered during the winter. Another photograph of Table Mountain was captioned, "Truly one of the world's natural wonders." The last picture showed a big white house, and it said, "Groot Constantia's famed and spacious cellars, the home of superb wine." Well, I thought, this will be a pretty good journey if we visit all those places. I decided I'd ask Hoppy about them when he came back. Hoppy returned after what seemed ages, but probably wasn't very long. On a train with the darkness galloping past, time seemed to disappear. The lickety-clack of the wheels on the track gobbled up the minutes. He plonked himself wearily on the seat opposite me.
"Sus, man, those gaffers stink," he declared, then gave me a big grin and a light playful punch on the point of my chin. When we get to Znin in an hour, we'll have some dinner. We stop for 45 minutes to take on coal and water, and there's a cafe across the road from the station. From Znin, I'm only the guard, and another conductor takes over. What's your favourite food, PK?
Sweet potatoes, I answered.
Sweet potatoes. Maybe and maybe not. I've never asked for sweet potatoes at that cafe. About a mixed grill? A two-bob special, eh?
I've only got a shilling, and it's for emergencies. Is a mixed grill an emergency? I asked. Hoppy laughed.
For me it is. Tonight I'm paying, old mate. The mixed grills are on me.
I didn't want to ask him what a grill was and how it was mixed, so I asked him about the pictures on the wall.
When are we going to see Table Mountain, one of the natural wonders of the world?
Huh? Come again?
I pointed to the picture above his head.
When do we go there?
Hoppy turned around to look at the picture, but he didn't laugh when he worked out what I was talking about.
That's just stupid pictures showing where South African railways go. But we are not going there, PK.
He started to study all the pictures, as if he'd noticed them for the first time.
I almost went to Cape Town last year, to fight in the finals, but I was beaten in the Northern Transvaal Championships. Split decision, but the referee gave it to the fighter from Pretoria. I'm telling you, man, I beat the bastard fair and square. It was close, I've got to admit that, but I knew all the time I had him on points.
I listened, astonished. What on earth was he talking about? Hoppy looked me straight in the eyes.
You're almost looking at the railway's boxing champion of the Transvaal, you know?
He brought his finger and thumb together in front of my face.
That close, and I would have been in the National Railway Boxing Championships in Cape Town.
What's a boxing champion? I asked.
It was Hoppy's turn to look astonished.
What a dumb cop you are, PK. Don't you know what boxing is?
No, sir.
I dropped my eyes, ashamed of my ignorance. Hoppy Groenewald put his hand under my chin and lifted my head up.
It's nothing to be ashamed of. There comes a time in everything when you don't know something.
He grinned.
Okay, man. Settle down, make yourself at home. We're in for a long talk.
Wait a minute, Hoppy, I said excitedly.
I clicked open my suitcase.
Green or red?
I asked, taking out a sucker of each color. I had decided that I would have one sucker in the morning and one at night. That way they would last me the whole journey. But a friend like this doesn't come along every day, and I hadn't heard a good story since Nanny.
You choose first, PK. What's your favorite?
No, you choose, Hoppy. You're the one who's going to tell the story, so you get first choice,
I said with great generosity.
Green,
he said.
I like green. My mother had green eyes.
He took the green sucker, and I put the raspberry one back and clicked the suitcase shut.
I've just had one,
I said, grateful that I had two of the best raspberry ones left for the next 2 days.
We will share, then, he said. You look first, because I'm going to be too busy doing the talking.
He watched me as I unwrapped the cellophane and licked it clean.
When I was your age, I used to do the same.
He looked at his watch.
1 hour to Znin. Just about time for a boxing lecture, and maybe even a demonstration.
I settled back happily into the corner of the large green leather seat, and proceeded to lick the sucker. 1.5 suckers in less than an hour was an all-time happiness, and having a real friend was another. What an adventure this was turning out to be.
Boxing is the greatest sport in the world, Hoppy began. Even greater than rugby.
He looked up, ready to defend this last statement if necessary, but saw that I was prepared to accept his premise.
The art of self-defense is the greatest art of all, and boxing is the greatest art of self-defense. Take me, a natural welterweight. There isn't any man I have to be afraid of, not even a big animal like a front row forward. I'm fast, and I can hit hard. And in a street fight, a little bloke like me can take on any big gorilla.
He jabbed once or twice in the air in front of him to demonstrate his lightning speed.
How little can beat how big?
I asked, getting excited.
Big as anything, man. if you've got the speed to move and can throw a big punch as you're moving away. Timing, speed, and footwork. In boxing, they are everything. To be a welterweight is perfect. Not too big to be slow, not too small to lack a punch. A welterweight is the perfect fighter. I'm telling you that for sure, man.
Hoppy's eyes were shining with conviction. I stood up on the seat and lifted my hand about another 8 inches above my head, which, of course, was about the height of the judge.
A little kid like me and a big kid, big as this?
Hoppy paused for a moment. He seemed to be thinking.
Yeah. Now, you see, with small kids, it's a bit different. Small kids don't have the punch. Maybe they're fast enough to stay out of the way, but one stray punch from a big gorilla and it's all over, man. Kids are best to fight in their own division.
He looked at me.
Who you want to fight, eh? What big kid gave you a bad time? Just you tell me, PK, and he'll have to reckon with Hoppy Groenewald. I'm telling you, man, nobody hurts a friend of mine.
Just some boys at school, I replied, delighted that even though this was the wrong place and time, I now had someone strong in the world who was on my side. I wanted to tell him about the judge and his Nazi stormtroopers, but I wasn't prepared to go the whole way. Hoppy Groenewald didn't know I was a Roineck, and he might think differently if he found out.
Well, you just tell them next time they'll have to reckon with me, Hoppy growled.
It is all over now, I said, handing him the sucker.
He took the sucker and started to lick it absently.
PK, take my advice. When you get to Barberton, find someone who can teach you to box.
He looked at me, squinting slightly.
I can see you could be a good boxer. Your arms are strong for a little bloke. Hey, stand up again. Let me see your legs.
I stood up on the seat.
Not bad, PK. Nice light legs. You could have speed. With a boxer, speed is everything. Hit and move. Hit and move. 1, 2, 1. A left and a left again and a right.
He was sparring in the air, throwing lightning punches at an invisible foe. It was scary and exciting at the same time.
Wait here, he said suddenly, and left the compartment.
He returned in a couple of minutes, carrying a pair of funny-looking leather gloves.
These are boxing gloves, PK. These are the equalizers. When you can use them well, you need fear no man. In the goods van, I have a speedball. Tomorrow I'll show you how to use it.
He slipped the huge gloves over my hands, which disappeared into the gloves halfway up to my elbows.
Feels good, eh? He said, tying the laces.
My hands in the gloves were just as lost as my feet had felt in the tackies when the fro first made me put them on. Only this was different. The gloves felt like old friends. Big, yes, and very clumsy, but not strangers.
Come on, kid. Hit me,
Hoppy said, sticking out his jaw. I took a jab at him, and his head moved away, so my glove simply whizzed through the air.
Again. Hit me again.
I pulled my arm back and let go with a terrible punch, which landed flush on his chin. Hoppy fell back into the leather seat opposite me, groaning and holding his jaw.
Holy macaroni! You're a killer! A natural-born fighter! You sure planted one on me, man!
He sat up, rubbing his jaw, and I began to laugh.
That's the way, little booty. I was beginning to wonder if you knew how to laugh, he said with a big grin.
And then I started to cry. Not blubbing, just tears that wouldn't stop rolling down my cheeks. Hoppy Groenewald picked me up and put me on his lap, and I put my arms with the boxing gloves around his neck and buried my head in his blue serge waistcoat. The heavy chain that held the whistle was cool against my face.
Sometimes it is good to cry, he said softly. Sometimes you fight better when you've had a good cry. Now, tell old Hoppy what's the matter.
I couldn't tell him, of course. It was a dumb thing to cry like that, but it was as far as I was prepared to go. I got off his lap.
It's nothing, honest, I said,
going to sit on my side of the compartment. Hoppy picked up the sucker which he'd put on the table before we'd started to spar, and held it out to me.
You finish it. It will spoil my appetite for my mixed grill. You're still going to have a mixed grill with me, aren't you? I mean, I'm paying and all that.
I reached for the sucker, but the gloves were still on my hands, and we laughed together at the joke. He pulled the gloves off and handed it to me.
No worries, PK.
When you grow up, you'll be the best damn welterweight in South Africa, and nobody, and I mean nobody, will give Kid PK any crapola. I'm telling you, man.
When we reached Tzaneen, Hoppy pulled down a bunk concealed in the wall above my head, which to my amazement turned out to be a proper bed with blankets and sheets. From a slot behind the bunk, he took out a pillow with a pillow slip and a small towel. He then put my suitcase on the bed to reserve it, in case other folk came into the compartment at Tzaneen. Taking me by the hand, we crossed the station platform, which looked much like the one from which we had left, only the platform was longer and the buildings bigger. Opposite the station was a lighted building with a big glass window on which Railway Cafe was written. Inside were lots of little tables and chairs. Several people were seated, eating and drinking coffee. There seemed to be a lot of smoke in the room. A pretty young lady behind the counter looked up as we entered and gave Hoppy a big smile.
"Well, well, look who's here. If it isn't Kid Lewis, champion of the railways," she announced.
An older woman came out of the back. Wiping her hands on her apron, she came up to Hoppy and he gave her a big hug.
"Your cheeky daughter's already giving me a hard time, Onui," Hoppy said. "She needs to go three rounds in the ring with Hoppy Groenewald, and then we'll see who's laughing."
He was grinning from ear to ear.
"So when's your next fight, champ?" the lady behind the counter asked. "Tomorrow night at the railway club in Gavelot. A light heavy from the mines. It's the big time for me at last," Hoppy smiled.
The pretty young lady giggled.
"Put two bob on the other bloke for me."
One or two of the other customers also laughed, but in a good-natured way. The older woman was clearing a table for us and fussing around Hoppy. He turned towards me and, taking my hand, held my arm aloft.
"Hello, everyone. I want you to meet Kid PK, the next welterweight contender," he said, keeping his voice serious.
I dropped my eyes, not knowing what to do.
"Enough of your nonsense, Hoppy Groenewald. Come sit now, you will not be fed before the train leaves," the older woman fussed.
The pretty young woman smiled at me.
"How would the contender like a strawberry milkshake?" she asked.
I looked at Hoppy.
"What's a milkshake, please, Hoppy?"
"A milkshake is heaven," he said. "Make that too, you lazy frump."
He turned to the older woman who was still fussing about.
"Two super-duper mixed grills, please, Onui. Me and my partner here are starving."
Hoppy was right again. A strawberry milkshake is heaven. When the mixed grill arrived, I couldn't believe my own eyes. Chop, steak, sausage, bacon, liver, chips, a fried egg and tomato. What a blowout! I had never eaten a meal as grand and was quite unable to finish it. Hoppy helped himself to the remaining food on my plate, although I slurped the milkshake in its aluminium shaker right down to the last gurgling drop. The pretty lady came over and sat with us, and Hoppy seemed to like her a lot. Her name was Anna, and her lips were very shiny and red. The clock above the counter read 10 o'clock. It was set into a picture of a beautiful lady in a long white nightdress that clung to her body. She, too, had very red lips and was smoking a cigarette. The smoke from the cigarette curled up onto the face of the clock, where it turned into running writing. The running writing said, "C to C for satisfaction." I had never been up as late as this before, and my eyelids felt as though they were made of lead. The next thing I remembered was Hoppy tucking me into my bunk between the nice, clean, cool sheets and the pillow that smelt of starch.
"Sleep, sweet old mate," I heard him say.
The last thing I remembered before I fell asleep again was the deep, comforting feeling of my hands in the boxing gloves.
"The equalizers," Hoppy had called them.
PK had found the equalizers. 5. I woke up early and lay in my bunk listening to the lickety-clack of the rails. Outside in the dawn light lay the grey savannah grasslands. An occasional baobab stood hugely sentinel against the smudged blue sky, with the darker blue of the Murchison Range just beginning to break out of the flat horizon. The door of the compartment slid open, and Hoppy, dressed only in his white shirt and pants with his braces looped and hanging from his waist, came in carrying a steaming mug of coffee.
"Did you sleep good, PK?"
He handed me the mug of coffee.
"Yeah, thanks, Hoppy. I'm sorry I couldn't stay awake."
"No worries, little booty.
There comes a time for all of us when you can't get up out of your corner.
I didn't understand the boxing parlance, but it didn't seem to matter. To my amazement, Hoppy then lifted the top of the small compartment table to reveal a wash basin underneath. He turned on the taps and hot water came out of one and curled out of the other. He kept running his fingers through the water until he said the temperature was just right.
"When you've had your coffee, you can have a nice wash, and then I'll take you to breakfast," he said.
"It's okay, Hoppy, I have my breakfast in my suitcase," I said hastily.
Hoppy looked at me with a grin.
"This I got to see. In your suitcase you have a stove and a frying pan, and butter and eggs and bacon and sausages and tomato and toast and jam and coffee?"
He gave a low whistle.
"That's a magic suitcase you've got there, PK."
"Mefro gave me sandwiches for the first three meals because my opa didn't send enough money. Only last night we had a mixed grill when I should have eaten the meat one,"
I said in a hectic tumbling out of words. Hoppy stood for a moment, looking out of the carriage window. He seemed to be talking to himself.
"Sandwiches, eh? I hate sandwiches. By now the bread is all turned up in the corners and the jam has come through the middle of the bread. I bet it's peach jam. They always said bloody peach jam."
He turned to address me directly.
"Where are these sandwiches?"
I pointed to my suitcase on the seat below my bunk. He stooped down and clicked it open, and from the case removed the brown paper package tied with coarse string.
"As your manager, it is my solemn duty to inspect your breakfast. Fighters have to be very careful about the things they eat, you know."
He unwrapped the parcel. Splotches of grease had stained the brown paper. He was right. The bread had curled up at the corners. He removed the slice of bread uppermost on the first sandwich and sniffed the thin brown pieces of meat. Then he replaced the slice. He dug down to the bottom two sandwiches. The jam had oozed through the middle of the brown bread, while the outside edges had curled inwards, dry and hard.
"Peach," Hoppy said triumphantly. "Always peach."
He looked up at me, his eyes expressionless.
"I have sad news for you, Piquet. These sandwiches have died a horrible death, most likely from a disease they caught in an institution. We must get rid of them immediately before we catch it ourselves."
With that, he slid down the window of the compartment and hurled the sandwiches into the passing landscape.
"First-class fighters eat first-class food. Hurry up and have a wash, PK. I'm starving, and breakfast comes with the compliments of South African Railways."
I flung the blanket and sheet back to get down from my bunk and looked down at my headless snake in horror. Hoppy had removed my pants before putting me to bed. My heart pounded. Maybe it had been dark and he hadn't noticed I was a Roynik. If he found out, everything was spoiled, just when I was having the greatest adventure of my life.
"Come on, PK, we haven't got all day, you know."
Hoppy pulled his braces over his shoulders.
"I'm still full from the mixed grill last night, Hoppy. I can't eat another thing, man."
I quickly pulled the blanket back over me.
"Hey! You're talking to me, man, Hoppy Groenewald. Who are you trying to bluff?"
He took a step nearer to the bunk and ripped the blanket and sheet off me in one swift movement. My hatless snake was exposed, not 6 inches from his face. I cupped my hands over it, but it was too late. I knew that he knew.
"I'm not the next welterweight contender, Mr. Groenewald. I'm just the verdammte Roynik,"
I said, my voice breaking as I fought to hold back my tears. It always happens. Just when things are perfect, down comes the retribution. Hoppy stood quietly in front of me, saying nothing until his silence forced me to raise my downcast eyes and look at him. His eyes were sad. He shook his head as he spoke.
"That's why you're going to be the next champ, PK. You've got the reason."
He paused and smiled.
"I didn't tell you before, man. You know that bloke who beat me for the title in Pretoria? Well, he was English. A Roynik like you. He had this left hook. Every time it connected, it was like a goods train that shunted into me."
Hoppy brought his arms up and lifted me out of the bunk and put me gently down beside the wash basin.
"But I think you're gonna be even better than him, little booty. Come on, wash up and let's go eat, man."
I can tell you things were looking up all right.
Hoppy took me through to the dining car, which had a snowy tablecloth on every table, silver knives and forks, and starched linen napkins folded to look like dunces' caps. Even the coffee came in a silver pot with S.A.R. in running writing on one side, and S.A.S. done the same.